السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. صلى الله وسلم عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا رسول الله، صلى الله وسلم عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله، يا غريب يا مظلوم يا شهيد كربلاء، يا ليتنا كنا معكم سادتي فنفوز فوزا عظيما. قال الله تعالى في محكم كتابه الكريم: أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: ولتكن منكم أمة يدعون إلى الخير ويأمرون بالمعروف وينهون عن المنكر وأولئك هم المفلحون. God states in the Holy Quran, بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: And let there be among you a community calling to good, enjoining right and forbidding wrong. It is they who shall prosper. Amanna billah. Sadaqallahu al-aliyyul azim. Let us once again enliven our hearts and our minds and our gathering with the remembrance of the Holy Prophet and his purified progeny. Sallu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Last night, I introduced to us the Imam's mission statement, Imam Hussein's mission statement, as he was preparing to depart the city of Medina, in that famous mission statement that he relayed in his will to his half-brother Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah. And he stated in this mission statement, he said, إني لم أخرج أشرا ولا بطرا ولا مفسدا ولا ظالما, that I rise not in vain or to cause mischief or oppression. وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي, I rise up in seeking reform of the nation, of the community of my grandfather. And so last night's discussion was on the mission statement of the Imam, peace be upon him, as it relates to the objective of seeking reform. Tonight I'd like to shift the focus and the attention to another important clause which appears in this same mission statement. And that is where the Imam continues and he announces his objective. He says, أريد أن آمر بالمعروف وأنهى عن المنكر. I seek to enjoin what is right and to forbid what is wrong. الأمر بالمعروف والنهي عن المنكر. And in fact, we find that this was an important objective in the mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And one of the important attestations to this is the testimony that is made by pilgrims to the burial site of Imam Hussein. Those who perform the ziyarah of Imam Hussein, in the ziyarah, they testified to this. They testified that the Imam had fulfilled this obligation. We say, أشهد أنك قد أقمت الصلاة وآتيت الزكاة وأمرت بالمعروف ونهيت عن المنكر. I bear witness that you took up prayer, you established prayer, and you did charity. وَأَقَمْتَ الصَّلَاةَ وَآتَيْتَ الزَّكَاةَ وَأَمَرْتَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ, and that you enjoined what is right. وَنَهَيْتَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ, and that you forbade or you forbid what is wrong. And so when we come to the history of Islam, and when we come to Islam as a whole, we find that this doctrine, the doctrine of al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar, enjoining right and forbidding wrong, takes a central place in the thought of various Islamic communities and schools of thought. It was a prominent doctrine that all schools of thought focused on. So for example, we find that a group who are known as the Mu'tazila, which are an early theological school that came up within Islam, a theological school, that they considered al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar to be one of their five major principles of faith. And there are many other examples that we can give to signify the importance of this doctrine in the general Islamic worldview amongst the various schools of thought. And there have been several studies that compare and contrast the opinions of the different schools of thought and proponents belonging to those different theological and legal strands in Islam on specifically this doctrine, the doctrine of al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar. However, our discussion tonight will focus, inshallah, on the Imami tradition. That is the tradition of the followers of the 12 Imams, the Ithna Ashari tradition, and what it says about this doctrine, the place of al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar, in the place of this doctrine in Imami thought. When we go back to the sources, we find that there is a period of about 1,000 years of continuous development and discussion of this doctrine in the various disciplines, in theology, works of theology, in works of hadith, in works of fiqh and law, that this doctrine features prominently in various disciplines. It's discussed in different ways, and this discussion is a robust discussion. Nearly every theologian or jurist, anyone who had produced a work in the disciplines of Islam, discussed and focused on al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar. And so tonight, I'd like to address several important questions. The first question is, where does this doctrine, the doctrine of al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar, where does it fit in the Imami religious thought? Where is it located? How is it conceptualized? To understand this, we have to understand that the Imami scholars, the theologians and jurists and other scholars, they categorized all of the doctrines or the major doctrines of Islamic thought into two major categories. One category is known as usuluddin, the principles of faith. The other category is furu'uddin, which are the ritual acts or the acts of worship. And so when we come to the first category, we find that in the Imami tradition, the tradition of the Ahlul Bayt, the 12 Imams of Ahlul Bayt, that the scholars, they mention five principles of belief, that these are essential to having complete belief, not just accepting the major principles of Islam, but also of what is known as Iman. And there are five principles. Number one is At-Tawheed, the unicity of God, the oneness of God. Number two is Al-Adl, divine justice and benevolence. Number three is An-Nubuwah, prophethood. Number four is Al-Imama, succession to the Prophet. And number five is al-ma'ad, the hereafter, belief in the hereafter, life after death. These are the essential, according to the school of Ahlul Bayt, the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, these are the essential doctrines that we must believe in. We must, they are a matter of faith and belief. The other category that we mentioned is what is called as furu'ud deen, and most scholars have agreed that the furu'ud deen, which are the acts of worship or the ritual acts, they are 10 in the tradition, and they are mentioned in the various sources as being the following. Number one is prayer, as-salah. Number two, as-zakat, charity. Number three, al-khums, in no particular order, another form of charity. Then we have al-hajj, pilgrimage. We have as-sawm, fasting. We have al-jihad. Then we have what is known as at-tawalli, meaning expressing proximity and closeness to those who are close to God. The opposite of which comes next, is at-tabarri, distancing oneself from those who were distant from God and the righteous. And then you have al-amr bil ma'ruf, number 9, and number 10, al-nahi anil munkar. And so the scholars have categorized, they have placed the doctrine of al-amr bil ma'ruf and al-nahi anil munkar in furu'ud deen, and they have considered these to be essential to the practice of Muslims. Just like prayers, just like fasting, just like hajj, and all of the others that are mentioned, al-amr bil ma'ruf and al-nahi anil munkar, enjoining good or enjoining what is right and forbidding or discouraging what is wrong or evil, is considered an essential act of worship, an essential part of the practice of Muslims. Now, this is the first question. So we know where this doctrine fits in the general religious thought of the Imami tradition, the Twelver Shi'i tradition. The second question that we examine is, what is the significance of this doctrine? What is its importance? How important is it? The importance of this doctrine is attested through the traditions and the teachings, the major traditions and teachings, the major sources in which we go back to for our teachings. Number one, we come to the Qur'an. The Qur'an, in several instances, it discusses the doctrine of al-amr bil-ma'ruf wa nahi anil munkar. I'll give a few examples. Number one is the verse that I began with, from the third chapter, Surah Al-Imran, verse number 104. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلْتَكُنْ مِنْكُمْ أُمَّةٌ يَدْعُونَ إِلَى الْخَيْرِ. And let there be amongst you a community calling to the good. And then there is a definition given. Who is this community? How is it that they are able to call to good? يَدْعُونَ إِلَى الْخَيْرِ. How does this occur? God says, وَيَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَيَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. That they enjoin right, they enjoin what is good, and they forbid what is wrong. This is the manner in which the Qur'an sees, it characterizes that community that calls toward good. Notice here, this verse shows us the significance of al-amr bil-ma'ruf wal-nahi al-munkar. It doesn't say in this particular verse that they should begin, the community should do good through prayers or through hajj or through charity. In other places, these aspects are emphasized. In this verse, the Qur'an tells us very clearly, it highlights the prominent role of enjoining right and forbidding wrong. This is one example. The second example comes specifically from the same chapter, Surah Al-Imran, the third chapter, a few verses later, verse number 110. God says, كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةٍ أُخْرِجَتْ لِلنَّاسِ. You are the best of communities that has been brought forth. كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةٍ أُخْرِجَتْ لِلنَّاسِ. And then God immediately tells us what describes this best of communities. تَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَتَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. This is first and foremost, the characteristic of this greatest community is that they enjoin right and that they forbid wrong. A third example we find from Surah At-Tawbah, the 9th chapter of the Qur'an, verse 71, where God says, والمؤمنون والمؤمنات بعضهم أولياء بعض. The believing men and the believing women, they are protectors of one another. بعضهم أولياء بعض. How? يأمرون بالمعروف وينهون عن المنكر. They protect one another. They guard one another. They help and assist one another, first and foremost, through their enjoining of what is good and what is right, and forbidding and discouraging what is wrong or evil. And there are many other verses in the Quran that discuss the importance of this doctrine. When we come to the hadith, we find that the reports are prolific in the books of hadith and others that emphasize the significance of the doctrine of al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi an al-munkar. Number one, we have the hadith by the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma sallam. He says, "Man amara bil-ma'roofi wa naha an al-munkar." The one who practices al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi an al-munkar, the one who enjoys what is right, enjoins what is right, and forbids what is wrong, فَهُوَ خَلِيفَةُ اللَّهِ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَخَلِيفَةُ رَسُولِهِ. He or she is the Khalifa of God on the earth, the steward of God on the earth, and the steward, the Khalifa of God's messenger on earth. Here, we can understand this tradition not as the Prophet being literal, that anyone who practices this is in fact the Khalifa. No, because we know that those who are the real successors of the Prophet, they are specific, a specific group of individuals, specific number of khulafa, specific number of imams. We know who they are. We recognize who they are. Here the Prophet is giving us an analogy. He is telling us, showing to us the place of this practice, the place of this action in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That it is on par with the objectives and the mission and the practices of the prophets and of the successors. Showing us the importance of this action. This is one example. In another example, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, he tells us, قِوَامُ الشَّرِيعَةِ الْأَمْرُ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَالنَّهْيُ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. The foundation, قِوَامُ الشَّرِيعَةِ, the foundation of the faith, of the sharia, is what? He identifies it as being enjoining right and forbidding wrong. It's the foundation of the faith. And we know that the foundation, without the foundation, the faith does not stand. It cannot stand up. It needs a strong foundation. And the strength of this foundation is found in this doctrine. In another beautiful hadith by Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, وَمَا أَعْمَالُ الْبِرِّ كُلُّهَا وَالْجِهَادُ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ عِنْدَ الْأَمْرِ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَالنَّهِي عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ إِلَّا كَنَفْذَةٍ فِي بَحْرٍ لُجِّي. Very beautiful. He gives us an example, an analogy. He says, if you were to take all of the righteous actions, right? وَمَا أَعْمَالُ الْبِرِّ كُلُّهَا, all righteous deeds, all righteous actions, and you were to compare them, on one hand, you were to put all of the good deeds, all of the good actions, and on the other hand, you were to place al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar. How would they relate to one another? All of the good deeds would be like taking a handful of water from an entire ocean. Meaning that al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi an munkar is as though you are in a huge body of ocean and all of the righteous deeds are just a handful. Showing us the importance of this doctrine. And there are many other traditions by the imams, peace be upon them, that tell us about the significance of this doctrine. So we realize that it's no joke. It's not something insignificant within the tradition. There is great emphasis on understanding, on recognizing, and on practicing enjoining good and forbidding wrong. The next question that we want to look at is, what is the objective of this doctrine? When we come to the Quran and the traditions, we find that they often supply us with an objective behind the various acts of worship and the various rituals. For example, when we come to prayers, the daily prayers, as-salah, God tells us, "Inna as-salata tanha 'anil fahsha'i wal munkar." That the objective of the prayer is to guard us, guard our souls, guard our bodies from engaging in indecency, indecent acts. It's supposed to be a barrier, a guard, a shield against performing indecent acts, if done right, of course. If done right. If not just observed externally with all of the correct conditions and being in a state of wudu and so on, but also if observed internally with the right kind of intention, with the right kind of devotion that it entails, it acts as a barrier from performing indecent acts. This is the example of prayer. When we come to the example of a sawm, fasting, the Quran tells us, "Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, kutiba alaykum as-siyam kama kutiba ala alladhina min qablikum." Why? La'allakum tattaqun. That in observing the fast, this will lead you to God consciousness, to taqwa. And many other examples are given. When we come to the objective of al-amr bil-ma'ruf wa nahi anil munkar, it is simply this. The objective is to be able to promote and maintain a well-ordered, a safe, and a progressing society. One that is safe, one that is well-ordered, versus one that is crippled through widespread indecency, immorality, injustice, wrongdoing. And this is what we see, that the objective is to manage a well-ordered society, to allow everyone to proceed safely in this society, to maintain decency and goodness in society and in the community. And this is why when we come to the Quran, the verse that I began with from Surah Al-Imran, verse 103, God tells us what? He says, "وَلْتَكُمْ مِنْكُمْ أُمَّةٌ," let there be amongst you a community, "يَدْعُونَ إِلَى الْخَيْرِ," that their objective is to do what? Is to call towards that which is good. وَيَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَيَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. Meaning what? Meaning that it is through implementing al-amr bil-ma'roof wal-nahi anil munkar that we are able to call towards that which is good. This is the objective. The objective is to call toward that is good. Now, we can think of and sort of imagine what the place of enjoining good, enjoining what is right, forbidding what is evil, is in society. If we think about the analogy of the immune system to one's body. Our body is made up of different systems that function with one another, right? They have specific objectives. One of the important systems within our body is the immune system. The objective and the purpose behind the immune system is to do what? Is to protect our body from harmful organisms and harmful substances. The system works together, it responds so that it defends the body against anything that is toxic, anything that is harmful. Right? And so, sometimes when we come to this immune system, we find that it has certain mechanisms that it begins with. So that from the beginning, it sort of creates a barrier from intrusion, right? This is why we go and we take certain immunizations. The purpose of the immunization is to do what? Is to strengthen the immune system so that if we, God forbid, were to come into contact with a harmful substance or an organism, the body can defend itself immediately. Other times, the body, we get sick, we become ill, and the body, the immune system, begins to fight in order to repair, in order to fix, so that the body is functioning properly once again. We can think of الأمر بالمعروف والنهي عن المنكر to function in the same way. To protect the community, to protect society from all which is harmful. And thus, to ignore this responsibility, to ignore practicing al-amr bil-ma'roof wal-nahi anil-munkar is risky. It's very risky. This is why when we come to the hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that in his final will, the sources tell us that after the Imam was struck by Ibn Muljam, during those final hours and days of his life, he turns to his two sons, Al-Imam Al-Hasan and Al-Imam Al-Husayn, and he begins to give them his final will. And part of the final will, he emphasizes to his sons, he encourages them, he tells them, لا تترك الأمر بالمعروف والنهي عن المنكر. Do not relinquish, do not abandon enjoining what is right and forbidding what is wrong. Why? The Imam says. What are the risks? What are the consequences of abandoning this practice? He says, فَيُوَلَّى عَلَيْكُمْ شِرَارَكُمْ. If you do so, then you risk that those who are indecent, those who are unjust, those who are oppressive in society, they will come and they will have power over you. They will establish their power and their authority over you. And then what happens? ثُمَّ تَدْعُونَ فَلَا يُسْتَجَابُ لَكُمْ. And then you begin to pray for relief. You begin to beseech God for comfort. However, the prayers are not answered. Why? Because you chose to abandon this practice. You chose to allow that which is wrong to come and to enter into your society and to overpower you. And society, in many cases, like the human body, can quickly deteriorate. Quickly. We can think of this example. I'll give you an analogy. For those who are students, you'll probably recognize this, or for parents of students who are committed to their children's educational well-being. When you're in school, right, one of the most important things is for you to maintain great grades, excellent grades, a great GPA score. It's important if you want to get into a good college, you want to graduate, you have to have an excellent, a competitive GPA. Now, you know that to do so requires a lot of work. It's hard work. It's not easy to get good grades. It's not easy to maintain a good GPA. And some of us, we know through experience that if we were to abandon studying hard, if we were to slack off a little bit and you get a bad grade on an exam or on an assignment, you get a C or a D or an F, what happens to your GPA? It plummets. It plummets. Suddenly, you notice that it's plummeted all the way down, right? And you're in shock. And your parents are in shock, and your grandparents are in shock. Everyone's in shock, right? Your GPA goes down. It's very easy for our GPA to come down. Now, what do you have to do in order to bring back your GPA? You have to work extra hard, even harder than before, because it's much more difficult to then come and bring your GPA back. And so, you might get an A, another A, and you notice that your GPA is slowly creeping upwards. Not in the same way that it went down. The plummet is quick, but the rise is very slow. It's the same way. Society, like the human body, right, can quickly deteriorate. And so, when we abandon our responsibility within society, then we have to face the consequences, and it becomes even more difficult for us to right wrongs. We face many more barriers. Look at today. We take the example of our society today, our nation today, the political landscape, right? When it has become much more convenient and prevalent for xenophobia, for racism, for all sorts of things to come out, right? And people now have become much more comfortable with all of the ills associated with this. And so the work that we have now is much harder. It's much harder to fix something than to prevent it from being broken. It's much more difficult. And so here we find that the objective of enjoining good, enjoining what is right, forbidding what is evil or wrong, is to promote a well-ordered society, a well-functioning society, a society in which everyone is able to progress without harm, without difficulty, without indecency or immorality, things that can harm our souls, that can harm our bodies, that can harm our communities, and so on and so forth. The next question that we come to. So we understand its place in the thought, the religious thought. We understand that the objective behind it, its significance, and the objective behind it. The next question that we look at is, what are the conditions of enjoining good and forbidding wrong? First, the point that has to be made is the question of whether al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar, is it an individual responsibility or a collective responsibility? What do we mean by this? When we come to the jurists, they distinguish between what is known as al-wajib al-ayni and al-wajib al-kifai. This is one distinction that is made between those acts that are obligatory. We have wujub. We have something that is called wajib. There are several distinctions that are made. One of them is whether the act is wajib ayni or wajib kifai. What's the difference between the two? Wajib ayni is that which is applicable to each and every responsible person. By responsible, we mean mukallaf, one who is of age, right? Like daily prayers. Daily prayers is wajib upon each and every one of us. All Muslims have to pray. And if we're not able to pray standing, then we pray sitting. If we're not able to sit, we lie down. It does not, we are never relinquished of this obligation until we perform it. This is what is wajib ayni. It relates to each and every individual. It's an individual responsibility. Al-wajib al-kifa'i is what is known as a collective responsibility, meaning that it's wajib upon the entire society. Everyone will be held by God for, is responsible and is accountable before God for practicing this obligation. Yet, if some individuals within society, they practice it and they fulfill it, then what happens to the rest? The responsibility is not on the shoulders of everyone else. So until it's practiced, the responsibility is there upon the shoulders of everyone. If one or more people, depending on what the act of worship is, they fulfill this responsibility, this obligation, then it is fulfilled for everyone. The vast majority of our jurists, they are in agreement that al-amr bil-ma'roof wa nahi an al-munkar is a wajib kifai. It is a responsibility, a collective responsibility, but if some people perform it to a satisfactory end, then everyone is not held responsible. Everyone has fulfilled their responsibility. So what are the conditions? The jurists, they have given many different conditions. Some of them have given 4 conditions, some 5, some 6. There are differences in opinion. Tonight, I just want to give 2 conditions, 2 important conditions that I think are relevant. One is that the one who is practicing, the one who is fulfilling this obligation, must be knowledgeable first and foremost of what is right and what is wrong. They have to have knowledge. They have to know what is right and what is good, and also know what is wrong, what is evil. And in fact, this is a concern not just related to this practice, to enjoining good and forbidding wrong, but to the whole idea of practice in Islam, the whole idea of the Islamic teachings, they focus on a much broader concept. This is why we come to the Quran. God says, وَلَا تَقْفُ مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ. Do not pursue that which you have no knowledge of. Anything that you do not have knowledge of, do not pursue. And this is relevant to various aspects of our lives. I've mentioned this before. Sometimes we find that there are those who have good intentions. They are well-intentioned. They are interested. They have passion, right? To teach others, to bring others to the truth, to help others learn. Yet they do so on a basis, on a foundation that is insufficient. They do not have sufficient knowledge and awareness in order to do so. This has happened to me several times. I've experienced this. Where someone, for instance, online is engaged in a disputation, in a debate. Right? They want to prove to someone who is non-Muslim, for instance, that Islam is the truth. They want to prove to someone who is non-Shi'i that the school of Ahlul Bayt is the school of truth. And so they get into an argument and they get into a debate. And then when they're not able to answer questions, which occurs quite frequently, they come and they ask for help. They say, Sayyid, you know, I'm in a debate with so-and-so online about the truth of the issue of Al-Ghadir, that the Prophet appointed Imam Ali on the day of Ghadir, and I need your help. Okay, what is it? How can I help you? I want you to provide me with all of the Sunni references towards Hadith al-Ghadir, the event of Ghadir. MashaAllah. You want me to do all of the work and you take the credit. Right? This happens a lot. We find ourselves in situations, or we may have seen those who they do not have sufficient knowledge and understanding, yet they pursue the specific act. One of the important conditions of al-amr bil ma'roof wa nahi anil munkar is that we have knowledge of what is right. We have knowledge of what is good. We have knowledge of what is wrong. That there is no ambiguity. That there is understanding and knowledge of this. This is one condition. The second condition, which is related, is that we practice what we preach. This is something that many of us hear all the time. We recognize, and for some of us it might be a cliche. But this is a very important condition, brothers and sisters, and I remind myself before I remind you. It's important that whenever we're teaching, whenever we are encouraging others to do something that is good, or discouraging them from doing something that is bad, that first and foremost we practice what we are teaching. I read a story once about a mother and her young daughter who were at home one morning, and they were, you know, in the kitchen. The mother was preparing food, and the daughter was sitting there and with her mother. Suddenly, the doorbell rang, and so the daughter, she ran towards the door, as many children do. She ran towards the door, she asked who it is, and then she opened the door, and there was a salesman there. And so the salesman, he turned to the girl and he said, is your mother home? Are your parents home? She said, yeah, 1 second. She turned around, she ran back to the kitchen. She called her mother. She said, Mommy, there's someone at the door and he's asking for my parents. So the mother, she goes, she leaves the kitchen, she goes towards the front door, and she sees the salesman waiting there. She immediately recognizes who this person is, what they want. Now she's not in the mood. She has work to do, she's in the kitchen, she needs to prepare food, she needs to get on with her day. She's not in the mood to talk to a salesman right now. So the salesman sees her, and he says, I apologize. You know, your daughter came to the door and I asked her for her parents and I'd like to speak with you. Immediately she turned to him and she said, well, I'm really sorry. I'm actually not her mother. I'm just babysitting. Right? So I apologize. I can't help you. And she closed the door. She went back. They're sitting later on in the day. They're sitting on the dining table, and they're eating their food. And the mother gets up, she goes to the kitchen to bring something from the kitchen. When she comes back, she sees that her daughter has emptied her plate. It's all gone. So she's kind of shocked. She tells her, "Where's your food? Where's the food that's on your plate?" Told her, "Mommy, I ate it all. I finished." Her mom said, "Wow, that's great, including the vegetables?" Said, "Yeah, I ate it all. I finished everything." Now the mom knows her daughter doesn't like vegetables, so there's something fishy. So the mother gets up, she goes to the trash can, and lo and behold, the food is in the trash can. The mother's upset. She turns to her daughter. She says, "First of all, I gave you this food which is nutritious for you. It's beneficial for you. You have to eat your food. You can't throw away your food. This is number one. And number two, and more importantly, why did you lie to me? You lied. I asked you where the food was, and you said that you ate the food, but you had thrown the food away. Please don't lie to me. This makes me upset. You must tell the truth in every case, under any circumstances. Never lie." So the daughter, she turns to her mother. She says, "But mommy, you lie." The mom is shocked. She says, "Wait, I lie? When did I lie?" Told her, "Yes, earlier today, when the man came to our door and he asked for my mother, for my parents, and I called you and you went, and then he asked you and you said, no, you lied to him. You said, you're not my mom, you're a babysitter." And so the mother realized. It's important for us, brothers and sisters, that we practice what we preach. The ahadith, in many of the ahadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that every time I teach you something, every time I tell you something, I am the first one to perform this act before I even open my mouth and tell you. We practice what we preach. I mentioned last night that successful reform is one that begins from within oneself. It has to begin with oneself. So too is successful in joining good and forbidding wrong. It has to begin with ourselves. And then finally, the last question that we look at is the modes and the levels of this practice. Scholars have stated, they have suggested, and the ahadith, they emphasize that there are several modes or several levels of practicing in joining good and forbidding wrong. One is at the level of action, that you act, you physically act in order to either enjoin good, encourage good, or forbid wrong. Now, what comes to mind here in many cases is that when we talk about enjoining or commanding good and forbidding wrong, and we couple it with action or physical activity, perhaps some, their minds go to an extreme, that is of coercion or of violence, right? And this is why, specifically, this issue was discussed at length by the scholars and by the traditions, that enjoining good and forbidding wrong should not entail violence, should not entail harm towards others, physical harm, or, you know, psychological harm towards others. In fact, they suggest that when it comes to this issue, if force is required, this can only occur under the infallible imam, and with the permission of the infallible imam. Why? Because the imam is infallible. As the representative of God, the prophet or the imam is infallible. But besides that, that force and coercion and violence and harm must be avoided. Now contrast that to some of what we see in today's world. In certain Muslim majority countries, we find that under the banner of enjoining what is right, enjoining what is good, forbidding what is wrong, that there is a level of force and coercion and sometimes even violence involved. In some countries, at the time of prayer, you have special groups, special councils, right? I like to call vigilantes, really. special counsels under the council. The name of the council is the Council for Enjoining Good and Forbidding Wrong, or other catchy titles. That during the time of prayer, they go from business to business, from shop to shop, and they force people sometimes through physical force and physical violence to close their shops so that they go to prayer. And there are many other examples that we can talk about. This is problematic. The teachings, they tell us that we cannot use force, we cannot use violence or coercion. So this is one level, at the level of action. The second level is at the level of speech, a verbal admonishment. When we speak and we try to teach someone, tell someone, verbally encourage them towards good or discourage them from wrong, right? This is number two. And the final is at the level of the heart. That within our heart, that we are not approving of that which is wrong. If I see something, if I experience something that is wrong, at least, and this is the very minimum, at least there is a approval for what is good in my heart and a disapproval of what is bad within me, within my heart. That I'm not completely indifferent. And the manner in which all of these modes and all of these levels is done is in a way that is gentle. In a way that assists the person to do good and to avoid harm. This is why the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Allahumma so beautifully in his hadith, he says, "Man amara bima'rufin," whoever enjoins good, "falyakun amruhu dhalika bima'ruf." Let the manner in which he or she does so, let the manner be good itself. Why? Because it defeats the purpose. I mentioned the objective of this practice is that we can have a good society, a well-ordered society. And so to do so in a negative way, in a harsh way, it defeats the purpose. It pushes people away, defeats the objectives of this act. When we come to the prophets and the imams themselves, this was their manner. There is a famous tradition that tells us that one day a man, he came to the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and he entered while the Prophet was in the masjid, and he was surrounded with some of his companions. The young man, he came to the Prophet, and he sat with him. He told him, "Ya Rasulullah, I have a question for you." Prophet told him, "Yes." He was very blunt, this young man. He told him, "Ya Rasulullah, I enjoy fornicating, wal'iyadu billah. I enjoy it. And so I want you to find an exception for me, right? Allow me, give me permission to engage in this act, the act of fornication." Some of those who were around, they became upset. How is it that this man can come to the Holy Prophet and speak in such a manner and to be so blatant with the Prophet and so frank and to speak in such a poor manner? So they got up, some of them, the tradition says they placed their hands on their weapons. They got up. They were very upset. The Prophet told them, "Sit down. Calm down. You guys go over there. I'd like to speak with this young man." He turned to the young man, and the Prophet, he asked him a simple question. Simple question. He told him, "Young man, do you have female relatives, family members? Do you have a mother? Do you have a sister? Do you have an aunt? Do you have a cousin?" The young man said, "Yes, Ya Rasulullah." He told him, "I'd like to ask you a question. Would you be okay with another man committing this act with your female family members and relatives?" The man said, "No, of course not." He told him, "Then you must also think the same way. You must act the same way. This woman who you desire to commit this act with, she's a relative of another person. And in the same way that you would not want this for yourself, you should not want this for others." In a manner that allowed this young man to think for a moment, to pause, to think, to understand. We find the example of Imam Hussein himself. the example that we've all heard and we've all memorized. When Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, they are young children, and they are outside, and they see an elder man who is performing his wudu, his ablution, but he is doing so incorrectly. And so they think to one another, what do we do? They realize they have an obligation. They know that this is wrong, this act is wrong. They need to teach the person. They should encourage him to do it in the proper way. So what should we do? How should we approach this? They realize that this is an elder man. And so they decide amongst themselves. And they approach the man. And they tell him, oh man, we are two brothers and we are trying to figure out an issue that came up between us. We want to perform the wudu, and each one of us is telling the other, or is not approving of the other's wudu. And so we would like for you to come and to see us, just look at us perform wudu to see which of us is right. So the man said, yes, of course. And so he came forward. And both Al-Imam Al-Hassan and Imam Hussein, they both performed the wudu in the correct manner. The man realized, when he saw this, he realized that he was in error. And so he thanked them. He turned to them and he said, I want to thank you for teaching me. In this beautiful manner, in a manner that is not harsh, that does not hurt people's feelings, that really encourages them, that promotes goodness in them. And so it's important for us, brothers and sisters, that we realize the significance of enjoining good, of discouraging that which is wrong, and each and every one of us in our own capacity, with ourselves, with our spouses, with our children, with our family members, with our friends. Any time that we see an opportunity to promote what is good, or discourage what is bad, we should not remain indifferent. And this, we find that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his focus on this and being successful in this was something that he learned from his own family members. Again, this was something that he learned from a young child, the importance of treating others in a good way and encouraging them to do good. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he learned the importance of this duty from his parents, from Amin al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib and his honorable mother, as Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam. He learned this. He found, in particular, in his mother, as Sayyida Fatima alayhi salam, he found a great example of this. That after the death of the Prophet and all of the challenges that came out and all of the oppression and the injustice that became prevalent after the death of the Prophet, the Imam, he saw his mother courageously go out. Fatima al-Zahra alayha salam, she did not sit at home. She was not indifferent to that which was wrong. She did what she could do. She stood up. And she went out in public and she stood valiantly and courageously against the injustice that she was seeing, and she spoke up in a courageous manner. She spoke up. She did not allow the injustice to continue by remaining indifferent. And Imam Hussein was witness to this. He learned from his mother what it means to be courageous. That if you see something wrong, an injustice, that you do not remain silent, that you try your best, whatever is in your capacity, to correct that wrong. He learns this from his honorable mother, Fatima al-Zahra. Fatima al-Zahra alayha salam, long before the massacre of Karbala, long before the day of Ashura, the traditions, they tell us that shortly after the birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when the Imam was an infant, a newborn, that the Prophet had come to visit his daughter Fatima, to see his grandson Hussein. And Fatima brings Hussein, Imam Hussein, and she gives him to his grandfather, Rasulullah. Rasulullah, he looks at him, and he is appreciative of Hussein, alayhi salam. He is so happy to be holding his grandson in his hands, in his arms. The tradition tells us that at this moment, Jibra'il, he descends upon the Prophet. And he reveals to him, he asks him, Ya Rasulullah, do you love your grandson Hussein? He says, yes, of course. I love my grandson Hussein. I love him dearly. Jibra'il, he turns to the Prophet, he tells him, Ya Rasulullah, there will come a time after you when this same beloved grandson of yours, Hussein, he will be standing all alone in a place known as Karbala. He will stand without support. He will stand without assistance, and he will be surrounded by the enemies, and they will come to him and they will attack him and they will kill him, and they are those who claim to be from your own nation and your own followers. At this, the Prophet, he begins to weep. He cries when he hears this news. Fatima, she turns to her father. She says, Ya, my dear father, Ya Rasulullah, what is it that makes you weep? Did the baby cause a problem for you? Did he harm you in any way? The Prophet tells her, No, my dear Fatima. But I received a revelation from my beloved Jibra'il, that a time will come when this son of yours, Hussein, will be all alone, and he will be beheaded, he will be killed in the land of Karbala. Allahu Akbar, the days they go by, and Hussein, he grows up. And the time comes when Fatima alayha salam, she has to depart this life. Fatima al-Zahra, after the oppression and the injustice that she faced, she has to leave this life, and she is leaving behind her children, including Hussein. The days go by, Amirul Mu'mineen, he passes away, Al-Hasan passes away, and that time comes on the 10th day of Muharram, on Ashura, as Imam Hussein alayhi salam is getting ready to bid farewell, to leave the camp, when he is all alone to go and to face the enemy, as he is riding along on his horse, suddenly he hears a voice from the distance. He turns around and he sees his sister Zainab calling him, telling him, My dear brother Hussein, come back. Return to me. Hussein, he turns around and he goes back towards where Zainab is. Zainab, she looks at him, she tells him, My Habibi, my dear Hussein, come down from your horse. I have something to tell you. Hussein, he comes down, he disembarks from his horse. She tells him, My dear Hussein, I want you to reveal for me your chest. I want you to reveal, to show me your chest. Hussein, he reveals for her his chest. Zainab, she grabs her brother, she takes hold of her brother Hussein, and then she kisses him on his chest. Then she turns towards the city of Medina. She says, Oh my dear mother Fatima, I have fulfilled my promise to you, my vow to you. Hussein, he tells her, My dear Zainab, what is this that you are speaking of? What is this promise? She tells him, Oh Hussein, during the final moments of our mother Fatima's life, she brought me close to her and she told me, Oh Zainab, I have a request from you. A time will come when your brother Hussein will be all alone, without aid and without help. He will be all alone. At that time, I want you to fulfill this promise. I want you to kiss Hussein on my behalf. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا آل محمد أي منقلب ينقلبون والعاقبة للمتقين. السلام عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله. السلام عليك وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك. عليكم مني جميعا سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت، وبقي الليل والنهار، ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. السلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته، وإلى أرواح المؤمنين والمؤمنات نهدي جميعا ثواب سورة الفاتحة مع الصلوات.